Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Jerome Weeks, sitting in for Chris Boyd, who decided to avoid all this humidity and go on vacation. Whatever happened to Fordism? Fordism was the label put on Henry Ford's idea that by paying his workers a decent wage and benefits, he would expand his market. He would create new customers. These days, one observer has said, we have what might be called Walmartism, the idea that if we pay workers as little as possible, they'll be able to afford only the cheapest products. Last year's obituaries for the American car industry may have been premature. Ford and Chrysler seem to have retreated from certain death. GM has pulled through bankruptcy more quickly than expected. But while Japanese carmakers have also been battered by the recession, they remain the industry leaders. They've excelled at smaller, high-quality cars. They pioneered the hybrid engine. What's more, the Japanese companies, from top to bottom, are organized in ways that seem to keep them smart and responsive. It's that organizational style, perhaps more than anything else, that's concerned my guest, Ben Austin. He's a contributing editor for Harper's. He visited Georgetown, Kentucky, where Toyota has its largest plant outside of Japan, and his cover story for Harper's is titled rather ominously, End of the Road, After Detroit, the Wreck of an American Dream. Ben, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Jerome.
If you don't mind my asking, what kind of car do you own?
I actually own a Saab car, which is made by GM formerly. They just dropped it.
Right. So. Well, I wasn't trying to catch you as a traitor. You're not owning an American product. I'll confess I didn't own an American car for 25 years.
Yeah.
But the reason I ask is that in my experience, many Americans abandoned the big three, often rather bitterly, because of direct personal experience with a car or with a dealer, or they had a great experience with a Japanese car. And so clearly the Japanese have done a lot of things right. I mean, Camry has been the best-selling car in America for more than a decade, followed by the Corolla, Honda Civic, Accord.
Yeah.
And in your story, you mentioned several worker-friendly advances that Toyota has put in place, things like on-site daycare. In many ways, Toyota has been what we'd call a good corporate citizen for Kentucky. So boil it down for us. When you went to Georgetown, what is it that you found so disturbing?
Well, you know, Toyota is the largest employer in the entire region of central Kentucky. And, you know, Toyota plus all their suppliers there provide most of the jobs that are in the private sector. For example, the high school in the town where the factory is based in Georgetown, I was told that over half the students there, their parents worked for either Toyota or for one of the parts suppliers. And I think if there's something ominous about their presence there, it's certainly not. They do a great deal for the workers, and they pay a higher wage than just about any other person in manufacturing there. But there's a kind of monopoly on thought that exists. It's not exactly a company town monopoly, a company town mentality, but there's sort of that expressed itself in several ways.
Could you explain what Quest is and why you found it troubling?
Yes, yeah, so they one of the things that Toyota did several years ago is they partnered with some other people who were helping them hire workers and making sure that they were right for the company, and they decided that they would place some of their best practices in the local school system, ways of working collectively, of asking questions and problem solving. And so really a kind of Toyota way of thinking was adopted by the school system. And it's now in the school system, kindergarten through 12th grade. And it's a program that has deep roots now. Hardly anybody questions it because it's really just part of the school system. And in some respects, it's not, you know, nefarious or any way. It's sort of like brainstorming and group work. But in other ways, Toyota is presented as the ideal. Even, you know, from kindergarten through 12th grade, the examples involve Toyota. You hear Toyota praised. It's not something you can question in sort of a class. And the place where I saw this sort of in the most striking way, that the juniors and seniors in the school district there have a manufacturing academy, which is sort of like an addition to the Quest curriculum. And I saw a simulated assembly line where the students were building little Toyota Land Cruisers. They're little sort of 6-inch plastic contrivances, and they were putting them together, and they were being part of a assembly line to do this.
The team concept that was being promulgated in these classes was, rather than the rising tide floats all boats, it was closer to, if the need arises, you'll need to know how to throw someone overboard.
Right.
How is that different from, say, an ordinary business management course?
Yeah, well, I mean, this is, you know, you would think that someone who signs up for business management in college, they're thinking about best practices. If you're a 17-year-old and you're hearing for the first time that hyper-efficiency is the best way, no matter what, you need to reduce waste. The fewest number of workers is the best. Like, those are concepts that are out there, but you should be able to sort of wrestle with them in several ways. Well, what does that mean from the worker's standpoint? What does that mean from the business standpoint? There's some time when you should, especially in high school, you should approach this critically and sort of pull at it and tug at it in different ways. And what I found there is that they were basically being trained to think like managers, even when in this simulation they were literally the workers. So what they were doing was they were figuring out how to do this in the most efficient way, how to build these little Land Cruisers. And they had 4 minutes to build them, and they would do it once, and they would sort of be timed for how fast and sort of how much money they spent on parts and on workers. And then they would do it again after sort of figuring out how to cut workers, how to do it a little bit faster, how to spread the work more evenly. And they're basically eliminating one another. But they never stop to question what that means.
They were never asked to consider their own self-interest.
Their own self-interest in this, and what it means from a worker standpoint, and if you know this, if this is how business needs to function in the 21st century, well, what does that mean for everyone else? That's not something that they approached. I mean, by the end, they had adopted this so completely that they were sort of incredibly psyched to cut one another out, and to high fives when they got the dollar amount way down.
Although I have to say there was a certain amount of comedy in the scene in your article, in that of course the slack-jawed sort of teens who were too busy texting or calling each other.
These are also teenagers who, while this is being sort of talked to them, it feels like it was much above them, that they were being told that the Toyota way is the best way, and that inefficiency is what you might see at Ford and GM, but at Toyota we're going to do this much more cleanly. And they're pulling out their phones and texting, and they're sort of not paying attention, and they're sort of talking about video games and doing all sorts of things. I mean, this is, which is part of the interest to me, because these are real teenagers. What teenager has ever thought about how you can best use 10 seconds? And whether 8 seconds, if you can do a task in 8 seconds, how you can use those other 2 seconds somewhere else. I mean, these are sort of such foreign concepts, and they were participating in it sort of mindlessly. But these are the big issues that are swirling around them, and that they're actually in a simulated way participating in, and in a very real way, as I was told, their parents were a part of. So it certainly was a chance to talk about it in much more complicated ways that was lost there.
What you saw at the Toyota plant was that manufacturing workers were increasingly being treated like service sector workers. That is, they are treated as replaceable, even disposable.
Yeah.
Walmart has to replace almost half of its workforce every year, and there was no investment in the workers. And why is this any different from what's happening in the workforce in general?
Yeah, well, I will say about Toyota that I write that Toyota is maybe the high end of the lower options available. So it's certainly not GM. If you think of GM as like our emblematic company of the 20th century, and that Walmart is the emblematic factory company of the 21st, that Toyota is certainly neither GM with all its benefits and its pensions. But it's not Walmart either, where the workers are completely disposable, and that's the business model. That the workers there were still getting, there was an investment in them, and they were mostly trying to be retained. I mean, there were a lot of workers who were temporary workers who were laid off all the time and hired back at much lower rates. So I sort of compared the Toyota workers to, say, a manager at Walmart, who has to buy into the philosophy of the company, has to do, their job is never exactly secure, but they have to be a complete booster for the company at all times, and they're paid a little bit better too. They're obviously than the person at the cash register. So they're above that, just a normal worker at Walmart, say.
This is Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Jerome Weeks, sitting in for Chris Boyd, and we're talking today to Ben Austin, author of the cover story in Harper's on the end of the road for the American auto industry. If you want to contribute to the conversation, you can dial 1-800-933-5372, or you can email us at think@kera.org. In light of the performance of the big three the past 40 years, people have plenty of reasons to badmouth them. They fought auto safety improvements for decades, things that would have actually saved lives. They fought gas mileage and pollution standards. Right. But I don't think many people of a younger generation fully realize what an amazing success story Detroit once was. In the 1950s, Detroit had the highest median income and the highest rate of home ownership of any major American city. It was the city where blue-collar workers could have a middle-class life. Now, was all of that simply because Detroit more or less had a monopoly on car manufacturing?
Well, there's something that the auto industry seems to represent. And you could say you could see this in other unionized industries. You might see this in steel before it falls apart, that there's a passage from blue-collar work to the middle class. And I think what we're seeing is that's gone as an idea. It's not gone entirely in a way, but certainly sort of the representation, the symbolic aspect of it is gone in the auto industry. And you're right, like this is, for over a century, really, or almost a century, the auto industry provided something really unique. From what you said before, from 1914, Ford pays a $5 day, and then the unions negotiate cost of living raises and pretty good pensions. And so this is a job where you could give your 30 years and you could come out and you're in the middle class. And that kind of job is incredibly rare today in the United States.
And you make the point that where the auto companies and the auto unions went, a lot of the rest of the American workforce followed.
Yeah. So by setting a wage pretty high, it raised wages in other industries, both union and non-union. And so we see the lower end of the wage earners raised as high as the higher end in the 20th century at certain points, and we don't see that anymore. I mean, we see much greater discrepancies, and I mean, as you said, the Walmartization, workers are working fewer hours, they're not able to get full-time hours, they're not getting benefits, and the wages are, a fourth or a fifth of what they would be at say, a Ford plant or a GM plant.
And you pointed out that although Toyota and other Japanese companies, when they began, paid union scale, although they didn't have unions, that increasingly that's not been the case, that they are now the leaders and the money is going down.
Yeah, I mean, there was a lot of, they had to be very careful about how they were perceived when they came. So they moved into an industry, and this is what it paid, the industry paid. So they didn't want to be perceived as shortchanging people. They wanted people to buy Japanese cars. They wanted to be perceived as American. And so they paid these higher wages. Even in a place like Kentucky, where the manufacturing wages were much lower.
This is Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Jerome Weeks, filling in for Chris Boyd. We're talking to Ben Austin about the future of the auto industry. And we'll be right back after this break.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, offering a progressive graduate degree with flexible part-time study. You can pursue your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Jerome Weeks, sitting in for Chris Boyd, and my guest this hour is Ben Austin, contributing editor to Harper's Magazine. His article in the August issue, the cover story, is called The End of the Road. It's about the future of the American auto industry. You can go to our website, kera.org. The story is linked there. If you want to contribute to the conversation, call 800-933-5372 or email us at think@kera.org. We were talking about the changes in the past 50 years in the auto industry and what's that meant. And one of the interesting things was the incredible rise of Japan and Germany since the 1950s. Richard Duncan, 8 years ago, wrote a book called Blood, Sweat, and Tears, The Evolution of Work. And interestingly enough, amusingly enough, he explained the incredible rise of Japan and Germany to the fact that most of their upper management was wiped out in World War II, that there was no opposition to new ideas, that they could innovate. And in a way, what Toyota and the other Japanese companies have tried to do is to keep that innovation, those innovation lines open by the idea of the team concept, by having the workers contribute to efficiencies, to innovations. If the big three are to compete successfully in the marketplace, so doesn't emulating Toyota make all the sense in the world?
Yes. And I think they have been for almost 30 years as well. They've been trying to. Failing in some ways. I mean, they're not building fuel-efficient cars, but as far as production system, the kind of efficiencies on the factory floor, since about the late 70s after the energy crisis, they have, you know, everyone's been chasing Toyota as a model. So they've certainly adopted some of these practices. And you might see that a Ford or a GM plant doesn't look that different from a Toyota plant today. The decisions in upper management may be very different. But sort of many plants, even outside auto industry, have tried to adopt this kind of team concept and to various success and failure. So this is not something, the emulation has been going on for a long time.
The turning point may well have been the 1979, the first Chrysler bankruptcy bailout, because the UAW essentially made concessions. It more or less, for good or bad, bought into the idea that part of its job was to help the company, that it needed to stay competitive. And it's been cooperating ever since.
Yeah. I mean, and that's, you know, people will argue how true those kind of cooperation or partnership models are, where the idea that workers can be part of management and making decisions. Now, people on the business end will say, see, this is an example of how we're empowering workers. And some people on the worker end will say, wow, this is a way to exploit us even more, to sort of speed up more work and to not only make us work harder, but to do like the classroom that I described, where we're pretty much supposed to monitor one another and make other people work faster and even eliminate one another in the end.
In fact, you quote a very common argument against unions, the line, look what the UAW did to Detroit.
Right.
But the UAW increasingly is like a paper tiger. It's not this major threat to what management wants anymore. It's in a sinking boat, as it were.
Yeah. Yeah, and they're you know, the number of concessions they've made to try to keep this afloat, to extend the metaphor, they're a shadow of what they once were. And they're certainly cooperating to try to keep something like GM or Chrysler together. Interestingly, one of the few places you saw their power, they've donated a lot of money to politicians in the last several years, in the last several decades. The UAW has more so than even the auto industry, the American auto industry. So you saw through some of these discussions when they were actually divvying up Chrysler that the UAW got a seat at the table, literally a seat at the table, and that their interests were heated. That was sort of a something at a non-union plant. You certainly don't get that kind of representation. You don't get that political power that you do from a union plant, where you have a union that's actually can lobby and can be politically active.
And yet, in most of the news coverage, much of the talk about the problems facing the American auto industry, the figure that's often trotted out is the $50 billion in healthcare costs, benefits, and things that, that GM owes. And I read recently that if that were the case, if that was really such a burden, why didn't the auto companies participate much more aggressively than they did in the healthcare debate? It would seem like universal healthcare would relieve them of that, and yet they didn't.
Yeah, and also in the 90s, when Hillary put this out, GM was also at the forefront of stopping it then. That they didn't, they were convinced not to participate in it. So, one, I think that's a, you know, that's misleading. Sort of, it's a very easy to blame the unions and those packages.
That's not the $50 billion.
That's a burden, but that is not the reason why the auto industries are failing. Two, you're right that as much of a problem as it was, there you don't hear them at the forefront of asking for universal health care, which could solve all those problems. So, yeah, in both cases, you're right.
And if we wanted to look at burdens at wastes, you cite the number of dealerships. Incredible discrepancy between what GM has versus what Toyota. GM had 13,000 U.S. dealerships, with each one in 2007 selling an average of only 280 cars. Toyota, by contrast, had only 1,450 U.S. dealerships selling 1,800 cars apiece.
Yeah, I mean, those numbers say it all. Very interestingly, of course, GM, through its bankruptcy, tried to reduce many of those dealerships. And now you have members of Congress who are fighting to save those dealerships. This is on the table right now. And there's a just kind of, you know, it's just how complicated this issue is. So they're all trying to save their local dealership because these are people in their districts and their you know, businesses that provide jobs. But how the government can also try to protect this, you know, amazing inefficiency, this waste in an industry, 13,000 versus 1,800. I'm sorry, versus 1,400. It's just remarkable. You can't try to protect those dealerships in that way. I mean, that's just not. They need to be able to reduce it some way to be more efficient in that sense.
Presumably, they had contracts with the dealerships, so it wasn't a case that they could just easily shed them. But in a bankruptcy proceedings, those things would.
This is exactly when they're able to do it. And I mean, this is just not an efficient model. And that's just one example of the kind of bulky waste that has developed. You can't blame that on the UAW for sure.
My name is Jerome Weeks. I'm filling in for Chris Boyd. You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. My guest is Ben Austin, contributing editor, Harper's Magazine. And we're talking about the end of the road for the American auto industry. If you wish to call, the number is 800-933-5372, and you can email us at think@kera.org. We had talked earlier about the pinnacle years of Detroit. Other than the fact that the Japanese cars were initially less expensive, they're not now, but other than the fact that they were less expensive, smaller, and ultimately better built, what caused the downfall? What happened?
Oh, I mean, many things. I mean, sort of all these contributing factors that we're talking about. People stopped buying these cars, and their market share dropped tremendously after foreign autos were better and sort of entered the market. They stuck with the SUVs during the 90s, and, you know, thinking about quick profits, you know, all the cars that the American manufacturers are making, these large trucks, the big SUVs, you know, sort of the emblematic Hummer. These are cars that during a certain time they were making a lot of money, but they're not developing, they're not looking to the future. Toyota's an interesting test case because they're, you know, I'm critical of them in some ways, or at least the sort of weird stuff that's going on in this town with them. But to me, they sort of represent more a non-union plant. But as a company, they have the Lexus, which is the number one seller in the luxury brand, and they have the Prius, which, you know, is obviously the premier hybrid, and they also have the Camry. I mean, so they're dominating in all three markets. And, you know, you get, you don't see that in the American companies. They didn't invest in developing these other cars.
Why can't the American car companies compete? Why can't they seemingly produce a car that people would buy at the rate they do for the Camry, the Corolla, the Civic, or the Accord?
Well, I think they certainly could. You started out the show talking about not buying a car, an American car, in several decades. And so I think there's just a big image problem they have to get over now, that if you have one of these cars, you're buying a lesser car. That's what people think. So that's something they have to get over. Now, people don't feel like that when they buy, say, a pickup truck or even an SUV. But they need to feel that way about other products these car companies make. And that's both you have to make the cars, and then you actually have to make people believe that they're good. And so those are both big problems to do.
My current car, I have to say, is a Saturn Sport Coupe, and I bought it precisely because at the time Saturn seemed sufficiently different from GM that it made a difference.
Yeah.
Now, of course, it's not even a part of GM.
Yeah. And maybe even when you bought it, it wasn't so different from GM. That, I mean, I write in the piece about Saturn beginning in right. Tennessee. And probably by the time you bought it, it was made in Wilmington, the car, mm-hmm. and it was probably built by UAW workers on the same GM contract as all the other UAW workers who at GM, which wasn't the case when it was built in Tennessee. And also, it probably shares many of the components of the other GM cars.
Oh, Saturn quickly morphed into Chevrolet by another name.
Yeah.
Let's go.
And there's you talked about failures of GM. Saturn is just such a clear example that they had this very interesting, unique brand. And infighting within the company, a failure to develop it, they didn't put out another model of the initial Saturn for almost a decade. They just let it fall apart. Mm-hmm. And they had a real market. They had an interest in something that people thought was, as you said, quirky and different. Mm-hmm. But they didn't find a way to capitalize on that.
Let's go to Jed in Tyler. Jed, do you have a question for Mr. Austin?
It's Ted, yes. The UAW and other union workers are paid considerable, and I think that was part of their demise in addition to the poorly made cars that they put out and the perception of the well-made cars on the Toyota side. I guess my question is, how much less are the non-union Toyota workers, say, in Kentucky, being paid versus the UAW workers?
Thank you very much.
And how satisfied are you with your Saturn?
Oh, I'm pretty satisfied with my Saturn, so it's 4 years old. Thanks very much.
Well, that's a great question. Early on, as this crisis was beginning with the cars, you heard all the time that GM and Ford and Chrysler workers were being paid $70 and $80 an hour, which sort of, you know, included both their hourly wage and then the cost of, say, all of their pensions and other benefits. The Toyota workers, a senior Toyota worker in Georgetown, Kentucky, makes just about as much as the worker at a GM plant, $26 to $28 an hour. They were paid that way, sort of on union rates from the start. Now that's lowering as time goes by. They're hiring a lot of temporary workers, but also as they're hiring younger workers and they're opening other plants, they're paying a lower rate. But to be honest, at the same time, we have the union plants that are following suit. As they're emerging from bankruptcy and they're also opening plants in the South and other areas, they're trying to pay less as well. I don't think you can say, though, wages are a really low component of the cost for these car companies. So, again, I feel like this is sort of a red herring to focus on just on how much we pay these workers, because this certainly is not their major cost. It's a smaller percentage than most other things. And so, you know, in any business, you're always looking for efficiencies, but the amount that we focused on this, the amount that we sort of were forced to focus on this, the union wage, I think really was misleading and blame the workers more than, say, you know, to look at some of the other problems of the companies, which you could fix.
This is an email question from the Brumleys. Not suggesting any sort of conspiracy, but isn't the current wave of layoffs and hour reductions serving the purpose of lowering the standards for employees in the U.S. and elsewhere, essentially accelerating the shrinkage of the middle class, which has already been going on for the last 10 years?
Sure. I mean, if you think of, you know, these are high-paid manufacturing jobs. We have, you know, now we have something like only 9% of our workforce is in manufacturing. So you get rid of more of these higher-paying jobs, and you have a, a middle class, or that shrinks, and you have a smaller wage. If you think of the other options, say in central Kentucky, when I talked to the workers there, both workers who supported the UAW, who thought about starting a union there at the plant, and those who didn't, when they thought they came from working at Dairy Queen or working at a gym, or they thought about they sold and they worked in retail. So those were the other options. And then this plant comes in, and it's a really high-paying job for the area. So the alternatives are not great in this country.
When the Japanese first started coming here, and we were having treated to a lot of paranoia and fearfulness about their buying power and all that sort of thing, I thought at the time that that wasn't going to translate very well. Their business practices weren't going to translate very well because their cultural differences. Our country is incredibly individualistic, and the Japanese have a much more an ethics of self-sacrifice,
yeah,
of working for the family, for the company. How is that playing out?
So when Toyota moved to Georgetown, they had about 2,000 to 3,000 openings initially. This is in the mid-1980s. And 142,000 people applied for those jobs. So they then had almost a two-year process where they interviewed people. They made sure that they had a kind of Toyota way of thinking. And they found, out of those 142,000 workers, they found 2,000 or 3,000 workers who fit the culture that they wanted, or they thought did. So when there are that many people who need jobs, you can find, and you have enough money back in you that you have time to have an application process that lasts that long. They also moved to areas that weren't traditionally union. They moved to the South or the lower Midwest. They moved to areas that were probably a little critical of the unions up north. And so they were able to change it in that way, too.
I'm Jerome Weeks. This is Think on KERA 90.1. And we'll be returning to my guest, Ben Austin, right after the break.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, offering a progressive graduate degree with flexible part-time study. You can pursue your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
This is Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Jerome Weeks, filling in for Chris Boyd. And my guest is Ben Austin of Harper's Magazine. And we're talking about the end of the road, for the American auto industry. You can read his article. We link to it on kera.org. You can find it there. And I'd like to go to Jan, the very patient Jan from Dallas. Jan?
Hi. And Ben, I'm curious as to what you might point to as the one or two decisions that the auto industry in general made, or that GM in particular made, that led to the downfall. I'm not sure if that's possible, but based on your research, what you might say were the worst decisions that they made.
Yeah, that's a great question. And
thank you very much.
Thank you. Yeah, I'll try to answer it. And I think not investing in fuel-efficient cars is maybe one of the biggest, and not thinking about the future, sort of getting caught up in the quick profits of big cars is one of the biggest ones. Maybe that's the one that I would point to most of all. But I think also just sort of operating sort of they just became these monoliths that they couldn't make decisions. I see this with the Saturn model again, that to have something interesting and was, slightly modeled after Japanese cars, and also the thing about Saturn is that they really did allow the workers, the UAW workers who were there, to take part in management. And so this was a very unique brand. And that all the other brands within GM sort of helped to kill it, that they couldn't make any decisions or fund it or the amount of infighting that would happen there. It just became an unproductive company.
Is there a magic bullet, a magic solution? I mean, at the moment in Detroit, you often find people sort of perhaps grasping at straws, particularly something like the GM's Volt, its
right.
hydroelectric car. Is that a salvation for all its problems?
You know, I mean, the truth of the matter is, and this is said over and over, that at this point we just have too many cars being made. The level of production that we've had over the years, people just aren't going to buy that many cars in a down market. And so we would like to save all the auto companies, and we would like to see them, every plant stay open and produce at the levels which everyone can work overtime and make lots of money, but that's just not going to happen. So it's one car isn't going to do it. There has to be some shrinkage to happen. But the Volt is definitely a start. I mean, that is looking to the future. So that's not a bad thing for sure.
And Tom in Dallas, your question?
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Recently I read an article from one of the popular car magazines about a Cadillac CTS-V going up against a BMW M5 and actually outperforming the European supercar and coming in, you know, $30,000 under in price. Well, then when I researched it, all I heard was about leaking windows, leaking moonroofs, and water in the dash. And I always thought Cadillac handled any differently than any other car in the stable? And maybe why can't the U.S. do that, get both things right, performance and quality?
Thank you
very
much.
I'll take my answer up here.
Yeah, I mean, Cadillac is their premier brand, so certainly they are not in any danger of going down. They're going to save that one. And I don't know that much about that comparison. I didn't see that. But I do think that even the Cadillac performing so highly, there's still that problem, the image problem of the auto industry, of the American cars that you would also have to get over, that someone might turn to the BMW first without reading that review or even after reading it because they sort of inherently now trust the foreign company more.
I should say that I probably should have said this at the beginning. I was born and raised in Detroit. My father worked for Chrysler for 25 years before being forced into layoff for the first bankruptcy in 1979, and my brother still works in the auto industry. So what I'm saying is that I would read a number of the auto magazines with a certain degree of skepticism. It's not that they're dishonest. You have to kind of get through a lot of the flowery, colorful description to get to the nuts and bolts of an article. There's a lot of they all love cars, and so they're basically fascinated with them. And so it depends upon which auto magazine you read, but I grew up on a steady diet of all of them, it seems. At any rate,
point, so you taking a break from an American car is more than other people?
Well, yes. Well, basically what happened is I stopped buying American cars after my father was laid off for more than 2 decades. And it wasn't until the Saturn that I decided to buy an American product. So I owned Audis and Toyotas and things like that. And as I said, I think many people above a certain age still have a faint memory of Detroit producing quality products.
Yeah, and the excitement for the new car and everything.
Oh, yes. It's really kind of amazing. The auto show hits Detroit and everything. It's like Hollywood premiere. It's something you don't really see it's hard to get excited about most manufactured products. They're just another product. But the car, I mean, all those cliches about America's love affair with the car, a lot of it helped to have federal funding of highways and things like that. But that's,
it's basically the largest purchase, you know, most of us are going to make a sort of, you know, a manufactured item. And it's one that we carry around with us, so everyone sees us with it. It's not like we have our dishwasher on our back. So
right,
it's tied to our identity, and so we think about it. We think about how it's made, how it drives, you know, its different features in a way that we don't anything else.
Right. It's like carrying your living room everywhere and showing people.
You asked before how Toyota broke into this market and sort of got over some of the cultural barriers.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things they did, and the other Japanese auto companies did this as well, is their first venture in the United States was a joint one with GM. So they operated a plant in Fremont, California, together with GM. They actually reopened the plant that GM had closed. They hired all the laid-off workers, and then they built both GM cars and Toyotas with a Toyota production system, and it's a joint, you know, venture. And this, you know, the other auto industries did this too. The other manufacturers did this as well. And so that's a way to get them in the market. And this plant actually has been in the news recently. It's called NUMMI. It's in Fremont, California. And as part of GM's bankruptcy, they're pulling out. And recently, Toyota also decided to pull out and close this plant. And for Toyota to close a plant, that's a big deal. They just don't do that. And one of the things that sort of is surprising to me is there's no real backlash for that anymore. You know, if a Toyota or a Honda or a Nissan had done this in the 80s, there would be an uproar. But we're so sort of desensitized, or we believe so much in markets in some way that, you know, that it just seems natural that if this isn't the most efficient thing, they should close it, rather than to maybe share, you know, make a little less profits and help out the California economy and the 3,000 workers who are there. None of the coverage is sort of critical of Toyota at all for making this decision.
And we have Alex in Dallas. Your question?
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I wanted to say the first thing a customer looks at when they're buying a car is, of course, the looks of the car. And I think American cars are coming in behind their European competition when it comes to the looks of their car. An example is the Pontiac Aztec, or some of the smaller Buicks, or some of the smaller GM cars. They're not making good looking cars. That's all. That's, I wonder what you have to say about that. If I may hang up now.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I imagine that also our sense of what is what looks good also changes over time. That when these little, you know, cars came out in the late 70s and early 80s, they didn't look good to people. They didn't look sporty. They really looked just like something economical. But now our sense of that has changed. You know, if you see a long car that's sort of very ornate, that's not attractive to people anymore. There's a different look. But you're right that somehow our sense of these American cars, we see them and they're not appealing at this point. And certainly they're paying designers to work on this all the time. So,
well, I'd have to say that the Pontiac Aztec was an unfortunate choice because it was a bust. I mean,
yeah.
And he picked like the worst product that GM's made in a while. But also, oddly enough, the Aztec was an attempt to break out of the mold. It was supposed to look unlike any other American car. It certainly
did. Nissan is coming out with a car called the Cube that is sort of Aztec-like. And it'll be interesting whether, you know, it's boxy in that way and whether that somehow does succeed or sort of goes the way of the Aztec and other sort of, you know, outside the mold cars.
It's also true that some cars aren't appealing to you, but they're shooting for a niche market. They're not.
Right.
I mean, the way the Scion, which was very boxy, for instance, has appealed apparently to a younger audience.
Yeah.
And some of the Chrysler, like the Chrysler 300, which I find a kind of aggressive looking car, a really kind of mean looking car, it's found a huge market.
Yeah. Yeah, or the minivan, which, you know, still, you know, some people, you know, I mean, that's sort of like the dressed up minivan, or the, you know, the big pickup truck, which for some people this is the ideal car. I mean, the look of it, the feel of it.
Oh, we should say that although the best selling car is Camry, that's still not the best selling car or truck. That the Ford pickup trucks still outsell. A question from Otto, who asks, how does having multiple dealerships hurt a manufacturer? If I were producing widgets, I'd think it would benefit to have thousands of widget dealerships.
Yeah, except when you think about even just transportation costs to all of those dealerships. If they're selling low yield and you have to sell your widgets at 100 stores or at 5 stores and you're going to sell the same amount, it costs a lot more money to deliver to the 100 stores. I mean, this is also, you know, you could say if you win the Walmart account and you can just deliver it all to a big box store, it's a lot easier than going to every little mom and pop store around the corner where you're traveling all over the place.
It also doesn't benefit you if the widget dealerships aren't very efficient. And so
right.
your widget, just having more widget dealerships doesn't make a better market.
Yeah, they're not each selling the same amount. They're selling, it's a limited amount. They're just selling fewer of them.
What, and you're right, what is collapsing along with Detroit is an American archetype, the premier 20th century dream of what it means to be a manufacturing worker in this country. Well, continually we hear from the digital folks, internet folks, that this isn't a manufacturing economy anymore, that it is an information economy. So what would be so bad if all the manufacturing was were done overseas?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's... We just have so many workers who aren't going to work in information technology. We have a workforce that can do these jobs, and if they're not, they're going to be unemployed. And you think about GM, even its bankruptcy. One of the things they proposed is to close. You know, they're closing many of their plants, but then now they're also opposing to import some cars and parts from plants in China where it's done more cheaply, and. You know, it seems like that's it's not asking that much of a company when you bail them out to do that work here. So it's to, you know, it's to keep jobs here. It's to keep people working.
So you're saying that it should have been part of the federal bailout, some sort of stipulations about future employment prospects here?
Some of it. I mean, this is if it's actual government dollars, tax dollars doing this. But you don't even see there's even the public shame aspect of it. I mean, they're trying to sell cars to this market, and part of selling cars to the market would be that you want to identify with these companies, and that seems like a way to stimulate that, to foster that relationship, is that you talk about the plants that you're going to keep here and the workers, and certainly Buy American is something that has been touted out before, and I don't mean that that's what they need to do, but being bailed out is a huge image problem for many ways, for many reasons. I mean, sort of even just going into bankruptcy. And the idea of importing cheaper made parts and cars from another country after that seems like it's sort of unpalatable. I mean, it seems like you could, you're not going to win over new buyers that way.
Well, speaking of bankruptcy and in their little time left, why was Ford able to avoid it and Chrysler and GM weren't?
Yeah, they were just very savvy about this. I think they had a little more money held over, and they were able to weather it and not go through any of this. They were able to keep afloat.
Well, thank you very much, Ben.
Thank you.
This has been Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Jerome Weeks, sitting in for Chris Boyd. Have a good day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.